But today we've, I think, chosen a good date for our subject. Yesterday, President Obama's inauguration took place, and he made a very powerful speech. I have to admit I haven't read every word of it, but I've read the summaries of it, and they do give some indication of the way that his mind is moving over the next 4 years. To speak to us about this, his foreign policy priorities, we have Sir David Manning, who is no stranger to this group. He's kindly spoken to us before. I'm not going to go through all the details of his biography, but what is relevant, that he was the ambassador to the United States between 2003 and 2007. He is director of Gatehouse Advisory Partners and a non-executive director of the BG Group and of Lockheed Martin UK. He's a member of the Council of Lloyd's of London, and he's chair of something called Ideas at the London School of Economics. But he has an enormously full knowledge of America and American politics and the way that American administrations work. And it is therefore a matter of great interest to hear his views today. I may say, I was in Washington last week. I go out on behalf of the group twice a year to give short lectures myself. And I always come back having collected what I take to be the new buzzword in Washington for that particular 6 months. A year ago, they were talking about what was then known as the pivot from the Atlantic Theatre to the Pacific Theatre. This year, they were talking about whether President Obama was an isolationist, whether there was a drawing back from foreign policy, and whether that was going to be the pattern of the next 4 years. I am fascinated to hear what Sir David's take on that is. Without more ado, I'll ask him to talk to us.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for that introduction. Thank you for having me back. It's very nice to be here. And can I, as I am here, just congratulate you on the forum? I do think it is a remarkable success story. It's become part of the national conversation on foreign and security policy, and it's a great tribute to you and your team, I think, that it has done so well. I would like to make one thing absolutely clear to this audience before I begin, which is that I speak for nobody but myself. I want just to clarify the fact I left government service nearly 5 years ago, so what you will get are the thoughts and opinions and prejudices for what they're worth of D. Manning, but they don't represent anybody else, so please don't go away from here thinking that you've heard anything but my private view. And can I just say, if there are Americans in the audience, I always feel slightly embarrassed telling Americans about their own country, so please feel free in the question and answer session to come back to me and correct me. Michael's asked me to talk about the foreign policy priorities of the second term of the Obama presidency, but before I list what I think those might be, I want to give some context, because I think it's very important to think a little bit about the backdrop to what the president will be doing. And the first thing is to say that foreign policy won't be the ultimate priority for this president. I'm quite sure of that. Michael's already touched on isolationism. We might get into that later. But I think I would certainly agree with Gideon Rachman in the FT this morning that domestic preoccupations will be the president's priorities. He will anyway be faced with the whole question of fiscal balance over the next year. He may have avoided, or he and the Congress may have avoided, the fiscal cliff on the 1st of January, but there are plenty of excitements and dramas ahead, not least in the next few weeks. And trying to find some sort of modus vivendi with the Congress over tax, spending, debt will be an absolute top priority for the President this year. And there may well be some alarms along the way. And it will be essential for him because if he is to build on what has been the American recovery of the first term, the economic recovery, it is essential that he is not, and the economy is not, subject to unacceptable shocks to the system, as it were, on the fiscal side in the next few months. The recovery in the United States has been considerable. If you go back 4 years to the first inauguration, the backdrop was very much darker than it is now. But the recovery remains fairly fragile. It looks pretty good if you're a European, I have to say. But nevertheless, nursing it along and ensuring that the United States economy grows and prospers over the next 4 years is certainly going to be his top priority. He's also made it clear he has what has become, I think, a sort of a tag word now, nation building in America at the top of his list. He's concerned about immigration. And he may sense that there is an opportunity to do something about immigration. His predecessor, George W. Bush, wanted to do something about immigration. But his party, in my view, foolishly, was at that stage unwilling to contemplate action on the immigration problem. Having seen the results of the presidential election and the congressional elections and the scale of the Hispanic vote for the Democrats, it may well be that this is an area that the Republicans will now be willing to engage in, not least in for a sense of political survival. So I think he will try and do something about immigration. He's also decided to lead with his chin on gun control. This is brave, if in the eyes anyway of many Europeans, essential. And after the sequence of massacres, I think he has decided he's going to try and do something, not least about assault weapons. This is a very tough agenda to be tackling, but it's all part and parcel, I think, of his desire to focus on America itself rather than the wider world. But, of course, the wider world won't go away and it won't wait. And even if he wants to be a domestic president, the foreign and security policy imperatives will be there. He won't be able to avoid the pressures on the United States to be involved. There will be arguments about how far he will be involved, but if the unipolar moment ever existed, it is obviously gone, but it is nevertheless the case that America, I think in the words of Madeleine Albright, remains the indispensable country for many international issues. And whatever the wishes in Washington, I have no doubt that the President will find that he has got to be involved in many of the issues that will crop up in the next 4 years, whether or not he would prefer to use his energies elsewhere. A couple of other points, I think, in this discussion about context and background. One is that he won very well. I am absolutely not with the right-wing shock jocks on American radio that this wasn't a big victory. This was a very big victory for the president in November. He won by 51% to 48%. He won in nearly every category of voter. He did that extraordinary thing post-2008. He was the leader of a leading Western country who's been re-elected. And only 18 months ago, there was lots of speculation that the president and his party would lose the Senate. They didn't. They've held the Senate. They did extremely well, all things considered, in the congressional election. And they have shown that they are able to mobilize support on more than a one-off basis in 2008. The president, therefore, in my view, has real moral authority and political capital. He showed that he was prepared to use it, I think, in the approach he took to the fiscal cliff crisis of the 1st of January. I don't want to exaggerate this. It doesn't suddenly mean that he's able to make a recalcitrant and polarized Congress do his bidding. But I think that he has been re-elected in a way that gives him some real authority. And I think that's important in international affairs as well as domestically. He's also a president who doesn't have to get elected again. That matters. That gives him more leeway domestically and is at the same time makes him inclined, I think, to think more about legacy. Finally, the foreign policy of the next 4 years, as far as the United States is concerned, is going to be in the hands of a different team. Of course, the White House is central. Of course, the president is central. But with the appointment of Senator Kerry as Secretary of State, former Senator Hagel as Secretary of Defense and John Brennan at the CIA. You have a new top team of three. They're hugely experienced. John Kerry has enormous experience of foreign policy. Of course, he was a presidential candidate himself. And Chuck Hagel, equally very active on the Hill during his time in the Senate on foreign and security policy issues, both of them with strong views of their own, and certainly going to be important in the policy-making process as well as the policy execution process. And John Brennan's experience will be very important in terms of the challenges in the terrorism world that lie ahead. So what are the priorities, and how far does the President choose those priorities, and how far do they choose themselves? Well, there are foreign secretaries in this audience, and I think that they, former foreign secretaries in this audience, and they will know far better than me the extent to which foreign affairs imposes its own agenda, however much you might like to drive it yourself. And Michael's already said in the introduction that last year the President was talking about the pivot away from Asia, and I think at the same time the administration was hoping to pivot away from the Middle East. When I was in the States in November, so before Michael, the buzzword was rebalancing. Pivot seems to have been replaced by rebalancing, but the basic idea is the same, namely that the United States administration wants to spend less time on the Middle East and more time on Asia. But that's easy to say and very hard to do. And the President has been re-elected against the backdrop of the crisis with Iran. It feels less acute than it did last autumn. But nevertheless, it's waiting, I think, to burst upon us again. The Israelis have their elections today. This is an extremely important issue as far as Mr. Netanyahu is concerned, and he seems likely to be re-elected. And, of course, the Iran problem is one that we have been wrestling with for more than a decade. The issue, I think, for the President is he going to be able to resolve it peacefully in the next 4 years, or are we going to be driven perhaps into some kind of military action? And my own view is that he would much prefer to avoid the military option. And I suspect that his team around him, the Kerry-Hagel team, are of that view too. However, I was struck when I was in the States in November, people who reminded me that he has taken no option off the table, and that it is not inconceivable that if all negotiated options fail, that he might be pushed into some kind of military response. I hope that, and I hope I don't hear about it, because I think if we don't hear about it, there's a much better chance of it working. I hope that there is going to be some sort of negotiation between the administration and the Iranians about the way forward. If there is, it will have to be, in my view, a big negotiation. It's not going to work if it's confined to the nuclear issue itself. I think one of the problems in handling Iranian negotiators is this, as they would see it, fixation on a narrow front. The Iranians are living in a neighbourhood where their neighbours are nuclear, Pakistan, India, Russia, Israel, and they have legitimate security concerns. We have to, I think about that in our approach to them. There are economic issues. Are we willing to engage with them economically, not least in developing the oil and gas industry? What is the recognition that the Iranians are going to need if they are to stop short of developing a nuclear capability and the weapon system to deliver it? There are no easy answers here, but I very much hope that the Obama administration will try to engage the Iranians on this and make this a priority. And perhaps we'll have to wait until the elections and the stepping down of Ahmadinejad in the summer, but I hope that that will be a priority. I don't know that it will, but my own sense when I was in the States 2 months ago was that this is certainly something under discussion. And then, of course, there is even more urgent on a day-by-day basis, Syria. What is the administration going to do about Syria, even if it does not want to become involved on the ground or directly involved and would like to see the regional actors and the Syrians themselves resolve this? There's quite a lot of pressure on Obama domestically, at least it seems so to me, with 60,000 dead now and the risk that some of the insurgents are becoming ever more extreme to take a more energetic role in deciding what to do about Syria. I don't think there's much appetite for it, but the risk of an imploding or exploding Syria in the Middle East is not one that the Americans can ignore. Is this an issue that perhaps he will try again to build some kind of coalition to deal with? Is this an opportunity for a second reset of relationships with Russia? I don't know. It would be interesting to hear from the Russian ambassador, who's here today very kindly. But this is not a subject, I think, that the United States can deal with on its own. There's the Middle East peace process. The Middle East is full of these issues that America can't get away from. The peace process seems a bit of a misnomer these days. There's not much process and there's only a very fragile peace. And it isn't easy to imagine that if the polls are right, that the Israeli election today is going to push this forward in any very obvious way. Is it going to be a grumbling appendix that Washington can sort of look at but not do very much about? Or will it become a really serious crisis again? Is there a risk of some sort of explosion between the Israelis and Palestinians in the next 4 years? We are told that Mr. Kerry wants to re-engage on this. If so, my own view is you need to do it right away. The Bush administration became interested in this problem in about year six and didn't give themselves enough time, I think, to address it. It's not easy, not just an Israeli skepticism about the peace process. There's the problem about talking to Palestinians. How can you have any sort of process if you're not talking to those who are running Gaza? Is it really conceivable in present circumstances that there can be a two-state solution when we already have, in effect, three states? What is the magic arithmetic and alchemy that is going to resolve this? The temptation, I think, will be to hope that it will sort of just grumble along, but as I say, a grumbling appendix could turn into peritonitis. And then there's the wider issues for the administration, whether or not they want to be involved in what is happening in Egypt and Tunisia and the so-called Arab awakening. The dynamics of the region are changing. America's relationships are bound to be affected by this, especially if this now moves into the Gulf in some way. So I think that the Middle East is going to be at the top of the president's in-tray, whatever his preference for focusing elsewhere. A second area that I want to touch on is, of course, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And here the president has committed the United States to leaving by 2014. And in his speech yesterday, he made a point of saying that the United States was at the end of a decade of wars. And getting out of Iraq and out of Afghanistan is very much part of his legacy. But getting out of Afghanistan raises all sorts of issues of its own. What is going to be left behind? Does getting out mean getting out completely? Is he going to leave a residual force there? And what sort of legacy will it be if after a decade or so of American and wider effort, some sort of political chaos is left in Afghanistan with a resurgent Taliban, and not least the effect this is going to have on the role of women, on education for girls, and so on. This is not the sort of legacy that the president is going to want to leave behind. It's not a good legacy either for NATO. And although I don't want to talk much about NATO today, in fact, NATO's engagement has been sustained and rather staunch over Afghanistan over a long period. It won't be a particularly happy prospect for NATO if this operation turns out to see the return of the Taliban and the sort of consequences socially that I've described. So is this another case, rather like Iran, for trying to engage the Taliban off-piste? Again, I open it as a question. I don't know the answer. I think it's striking that the Americans are apparently allowing the Taliban to be politically active in the Gulf, and I hoped very much that there is an effort to find some sort of political accommodation, some new political settlement in Afghanistan at the same time as the troops are being withdrawn. Whether or not the Taliban is, of course, up for that is a separate question. The other area of obvious priority for the Obama administration is not new. It's Asia, it's China, it's India, it's the whole question of the shift of economic and political power and influence to Asia. And for the United States, China has become, if not the key, certainly a key bilateral relationship. And it has many layers. It's crucial to the United States for economic and trade reasons. It's crucial to the United States in terms of its own relationships with Asian countries and China's relationships with those Asian countries and the United States' role in Asia. And one of the things that has not been worked out by the United States and China in the first Obama term and is up for discussion in the second is what sort of long-term relationship are Beijing and Washington going to develop? There is a new leadership taking charge in Beijing, and it may be that this offers new opportunities to a newly elected president. What are the elements that are inevitable of competition, and what are the elements where cooperation might be possible? How urgent is it for the United States to try and defuse the looming confrontations, as it seems, between the Chinese and their neighbours over maritime boundaries and over the islands in the South China Sea? This seems to me to be one of the real flashpoints, not because I think any country necessarily individually wants to start a shooting war, but because accidents happen. And finding some way of managing this crisis and lowering the temperature is a real priority. And it's very important for the United States because, of course, it has its own security commitments, not least to Japan, and will find itself engaged if there is some sort of accidental or deliberate military confrontation in North Asia. Al-Qaeda and terrorism, these issues are not going to go away either, whatever the domestic priorities on the president's desk, and we have all seen the impact of that in the last few weeks. The issue for the president, as I've said, in Afghanistan is to make sure that an Afghanistan is left behind that isn't a free fire zone for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But he has a global problem on his hands. We all have a global problem on our hands. What is the impact of terrorism going to be in the Middle East, in the Gulf, Somalia, Yemen, and now across the Maghreb? It's quite a thought that Mali is now on the front pages of British newspapers. I doubt whether such a thought was conceivable a year ago. And we have got the crisis, as we've seen in Algeria. What is going to be the approach of the United States, of its partners, of its UN partners, to Al-Qaeda and terrorism? How far is it going to be possible to put together some sort of a coalition to tackle the social, economic, political, institutional problems of failed or failing states or empty spaces? This is all something that I think the president is going to have to address, whether or not this is something he would choose to tackle in a different world. If not, the risk, of course, is that the situations grow worse and you find yourself sucked into situations that you don't, that if you tackled earlier might be less severe. Finally, Europe. Once upon a time, Europe would have been at the top of my list. These days, Europe is quite a low priority for the United States, I think, and for the president. I think that, you know, one of the things about President Obama is he's not a Cold War or post-Cold War president. He's somebody who's actually focused in his international relations not on Europe at all. Not because I think he's in any sense, I don't want to give any sense of the suggestion that he's, you know, he's indifferent to Europe or he's anti-Europe, but it's just not a top priority for him. This is a president whose time in public life has been focused on other things. He grew up in the Pacific. And Europe, in a sense, isn't a problem. There's a lot of head-shaking about Europe, in my experience. A worry, certainly when I was there a couple of months ago, that Europeans generally are unable to grapple with their problems or show a sort of urgency about dealing with them. And a bit of a tendency to see us all as a giant basket case, to which the reply, certainly as far as I was concerned, was, well, you know, you want us to sort our economic problems out. It'd be very nice if you would show that you could govern yourselves and sort out the fiscal cliff. So there's a lot of mirror imaging here. But I think, you know, we're kidding ourselves, the Europeans in the audience, if we think that we are a particularly high priority for the United States. There is a sense, I think, that Europe is not doing itself justice, that it's introverted, it's focused on its own problems, it's not pulling its weight, and there's a lot of head-shaking about defence expenditure in Europe and the willingness to be involved, whatever may be the record in Afghanistan. But I think there is one element here that I would certainly find promising and which might affect this this argument, which is the possibility that the second Obama term will see an effort to negotiate a free trade area between the two sides of the Atlantic. And I would very much favour that. First of all, if the economists are right, if a free trade area became a possibility and were negotiated and tackled such things as existing tariff barriers and regulation and so on, it could add 0.5% to the GDP of Europeans and indeed of Americans. And at a time when Europe, anyway, is mostly in recession, 0.5% is a great deal better than nothing. And it would still make an impact on the United States, and some economists believe it would have a bigger effect than that. Now, this is still going to be a difficult negotiation if it gets off the ground, not least among those who argue that we should not be going in for regional free trade arrangements. We need global arrangements. But since the Doha Round has manifestly failed, it seems to me not unreasonable for the Atlantic Partnership to try and do something about free trade in its own area. And so I would welcome it for economic reasons. I'd welcome it for political reasons. I worry, I must say, that the Western world generally is a bit fatalistic. It's not obvious to me that we're trying to shape our environment rather than be shaped by it. And for us to get out and try and negotiate a free trade area, I think, would be a welcome display of energy and purpose. And I think it would also do something to re-inject some life into the transatlantic relationship, which is, I'm not going to say moribund, but I don't think, as I've said, it's at the top of anybody's agenda at the moment. And finally, I would welcome it, and certainly there will be people in the audience who will not share this view, because I think it would strengthen very much the case for Britain staying in the European Union when we're making arguments about whether or not the UK benefits economically from membership or whether it would do better outside. I'm certainly very clear where I am on that. I think it would be a great mistake for Britain to leave the European Union, and not just, incidentally, for economic reasons and trade reasons, and we could talk about this later perhaps. But I think it would undoubtedly strengthen the case for those who say our membership of the European Union as a great trading bloc has just been enhanced through this treaty. I'm conscious that I'm out of time. I'm conscious, too, that the list is much longer than I have made it. There are a lot of unknown unknowns out there that will ambush the President in his second term, and some of the known unknowns will ambush him as well. But I come back to where I started. I think that he does want to be a domestic president. I think that's what the American people want. I think there is a sort of exhaustion with foreign adventures. But I don't myself believe it will lead to isolationism. I believe it may result in a greater reluctance to be involved, a greater expectation that others will take more of the strain. But I think myself it is impossible for the United States to become isolationist in the sense that it won't be involved in the great political and security issues of the day. Globalisation may be a pat term, but the fact is that the last time the United States was seriously isolationist before the Second World War, it made some kind of sense. This time in an era of global terrorism, cyber warfare, energy crises and all the rest, I think it is impossible to imagine a United States that really withdraws from the world on any great scale. It may be reluctant to be involved, it may take more encouragement to be involved, it may look to its partners and allies to do more, but I don't think that even if President Obama wants a domestic 4 years, he will be left alone to have it. My final thought is, too, if he were able to deliver some sort of deal over Iran or get some movement on other crises in the Middle East or elsewhere, this might be a very welcome way of burnishing his legacy. Thank you.